and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and we have a special show for you today coming from the conference room of the Forum Hotel in Rome.
Jack and Joe Heschmeyer are our guests, and our topic, as it is whenever these gentlemen are with us, is the flannel panel, the news of the world from a Catholic perspective. We're on pilgrimage. The pilgrims are here in the room with us from all over the United States, from as far away as Australia. Do we have our Australians with us? Welcome Australia as well. Lots of flannel shirts in the room today, but some intransigent folks who refuse to welcome Father Tazi. I want to thank all of you in the room for joining us on this pilgrimage. Some months ago, we began inviting people to come with us on the pilgrimage, and we're really, really honored that you accepted the invitation, that you came. It means everything to us, and I hope we'll do it many, many times again. I hope we'll see you in the United States, or maybe when we're in Australia, or wherever we might get the chance to run into you. Let me start by introducing Chris Cech. You already know him if you're here in the room. Those listening will want to know this is Chris Cech, the president of Catholic Answers, a very fine speaker and an enthusiastic marcher between churches in the city of Rome. Chris Cech.
Thanks for having me, Cy.
And over on this side, Joe Heschmeyer, apologist to Catholic Answers, author of a bunch of books, including, does anybody know the name of his most recent book? You can just tell me if I get it right. The Eucharist is really Jesus. Did I do it? It's amazing. This time in Rome with you hitting me has really straightened me out a great deal. Joe Heschmeyer, welcome.
Thank you.
There's four segments of the show today. And what we usually do is the news of the world from a Catholic perspective when we do the flannel panel. In part because this show is being recorded and will air later and we don't know what will happen in the world. And also because pilgrims raised really good questions that I thought would be fun to raise with these guys. I'm going to focus mostly on things that came up in the pilgrimage. So,
Urbi et Orbi, for those who are familiar with the term.
You're
news of the
right?
city
because
and the world.
Elena of Rome explained Urbi et Orbi, right? To the world. No, this, to the city and the world.
City and the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I have no idea what the relevance of that was.
Because we're doing Rome stuff and international stuff.
Oh, but specifically, I was saying we're not going to do the international stuff.
Oh, that's okay. Well, Urbi, whatever, not Orbi.
Yeah.
You began by saying, as always, we're going to do news of the world from a Catholic perspective.
Welcome to the flannel panel, everyone. let me start with a question that actually quite a few people said, because I did ask you, the pilgrims, to give ideas. And quite a few people had the suggestion, why don't we talk about beauty? Because there is so much of it in the churches that we explored here. And many of us feel there's so little of it in our local parish, at our local Catholic university, the local Catholic hospital, whatever it is, Catholic institutions in the United States, and maybe in Australia as well. And you speak for the entire world, Australians, by the way. So in the rest of the world as well, we have this problem. Okay, thank you. Look at how willing the Australians are to speak for the rest of the world. They're like, yeah, all right, we'll talk for everybody. Africa, we have this problem in Africa. Yes, the Australians say yes, we have this problem in Africa as well. So let me just start by asking, the beauty is so striking in the churches here. Is it because we're modern? Why have we given up on beauty in churches?
I think there's a lot of reasons. I think one of the reasons is that we're pretty functionalist. You know, we want to make sure everything we do is done as efficiently and economically as it can be. And that runs to cross purposes with something like beauty. You can see this really clearly, even stepping away from the question of like liturgical beauty and beauty in churches, just compare public buildings in your city from 100 years ago compared to the public buildings being made today. And chances are good, if you go to a building made 100, 120, 150 years ago, they had beautiful ornamentation that served no purpose other than just to be beautiful.
Like rustication, for example, on the side of the building?
Gargoyles, things like this. Okay. You know, like all sorts of, like I said, ornamentation.
Gargoyles serve a purpose.
Fair purpose.
They keep away the evil spirits. No, that's what they do.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, those are actually grotesques. Gargoyles, I guess also have the drainage purpose. Fine. Take another example of ornamentation. You see what I put up with on this pilgrimage.
Yeah, but like any kind of Victorian building will be very ornamented. It looks like an ornament.
Exactly. And oftentimes, this ornamentation is even at heights that nobody's really going to get a close look at. But yeah, it's just done because the thing deserves to be beautiful.
I think that it's not entirely fair to say that there's an absence of beauty or ecclesial or liturgical beauty in the United States. There are places where we can find it if we're willing to look. And I also think that it's making a substantial or significant, perhaps is a better word, comeback. There certainly was a period in well, let's just say in the post-conciliar age, when attention to beauty in church architecture did not get the respect that it did prior to. Some of this, I think, was a function of a loss of reverence in liturgy, and then that manifests itself in a lack of reverence in building. But I think many of the truly ugly churches, and there are some in San Diego, and there are some all over.
Probably everywhere. Yeah, there's some.
I actually think those are, they're not really being built right now. Churches that are being built right now, I think of our friends at St. Michael's Abbey in Orange County. I think of Clear Creek, for example. I think of Bishop Burbage, who is now Arlington, but he was Raleigh. Built an absolutely beautiful cathedral. There is a very high density of beauty here in the city of Rome.
Very high density.
It's 2,000 years old, and the United States is, 200, and yeah. It's not a Catholic country either. But there's a growing interest or return to beauty. There was a bad time, and I think it's in the past. I pray it's in the
well,
past.
Well, I think it was Father Hugh Barber that used to point out to us that in everything, postmodernism is a disaster. Except in architecture, postmodernism is a very positive thing, because postmodern architecture is not the tall glass building, the Chicago glass building that is truly. I mean, I think was the architect von Mises, is that from Chicago that built those?
No, von Mises was the atheist economic theorist that libertarians like.
I would be very surprised if he built something, but I bet it wouldn't be good, if that was your point.
Yes. No, but I've forgotten his name.
He would be good at keeping to the bottom line.
Mies van der Rohe, yeah.
Van der
Rohe. See how I stored von Mises and Mies van der Rohe right next to each other in my
brain?
They probably knew each other, yeah. I hate Mises to pieces, to tell you the truth. Van der Rohe, I think, said he wanted to build celebrations of steel and glass. That's a horrible thing to do.
I would not go to a party that was celebrating steel and glass.
Yeah. So it does seem that in postmodernism, the period after modernism is in architecture is a period in which you blend styles and you get these buildings that they don't have a particular style themselves, like a mid-century building would have, but they're drawing on others. And they're actually beautiful again. I feel like we're out of the depths in architecture.
I think we've hit the nadir both liturgically and in secularly.
And these things are related and architecturally.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, the people who designed really ugly churches lived in houses where they added shag carpet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it is not like they were bad at church architecture and good at private architecture.
Right.
They just had bad taste.
Yeah, but those green refrigerators are coming back. I failed to mention the shrine in La Crosse where my brother is that Duncan Stroik built. That's also quite beautiful. I think there's something else that's important to understand here. Of course, we know the various people, Bramante, Michelangelo, et cetera, who were involved in St. Peter's, Bernini with the colonnade, et cetera.
Adam Smith was not an architect.
He was a little bit later. Okay. He couldn't have been involved. But most of the churches we've seen, I mean, the vast majority, we really don't know. We might know who the cardinal was who wrote the check for the thing. But it was not a celebration of the architect's talent.
Right.
Or even the artist. This is the thing that I've been really struck by.
Yeah.
Is many times you find these genuinely classic works of art and they say, well, scholars have debated who painted it. Like, they didn't put their name on it. They didn't make a big show of it.
Right.
And so I think when we talk about why aren't churches in the US and Australia, et cetera, more beautiful, or it can't be because it's too expensive. That cannot be the only reason, because we are financially better off than the people who built the masterpieces.
Well, that's certainly true.
And Joe, you've kind of finished the sentence for me, but the motive of the designer, yes. I think is a central thing, is a central reality that we have to understand in trying to make sense between the divergence from a beautiful Christian age to an ugly post-Christian age.
As much as I want to agree that the ugly age is over, and it is in terms of the worst excesses.
I think ugliness can come back.
I don't think it can come back. I think so. I was at a parish where there was a building campaign afoot, and the question was, well, do you build the church first, or do you build the gymnasium first that you can then have mass in, and then build out for the school and build it? Because the idea is give them the church last, and they'll keep giving you money until you can get the church. If you start with the church, they don't give any more money for the school or the...
Well, you know,
look at Father Tazi nodding. He's like, I know how this works.
This is absolutely... This conversation happens in every diocese, I would venture, in the country, if not the world. The problem is people just say, fine, we'll just worship God in a gym.
Except,
for
you know,
decades.
Hang on a second, Joe. I have to disagree a little bit, I think, because this scheme that you described was the directed plan by the first or second Baltimore Council in the latter part of the 19th century. And it is the scheme or plan by which the really beautiful churches across America, sort of neo-Gothic especially, were constructed. They built the school gymnasium first, had mass in the gym, and then they built the church. And that's why we had that plan actually did function quite well.
That plan did function well past tense 19th century.
Right.
My point was that where this plan has gone off the rails
is they just stay in the gym.
Yes, we have.
Yeah.
And we're in a situation right now in most places where the people who have the money are also the ones who came of age during the worst periods liturgically. And their ability to stomach really bad liturgy in really bad settings is higher than most, we'll say. And so trying to be like, well, look, we're going to have mass in the gym if you don't write a check. They're immune to it.
Yeah, they're like, well, I'm doing fine.
This gym is better than the church. Really, yeah, at least the gym's not around or whatever.
Go ahead. Please, well, I got one I want to
get. You said we had 3 hours. I think there's also something in the American character, I'm afraid, on this one, and I would call it a defect, where we regard beauty for beauty's sake or beauty for God's sake as sort of like inefficient or
not practical.
That's the American Protestant.
Oh, you began with that?
Well, the notion of subverting contemplative realities,
yes.
You know, contemplative truth for truth's sake, beauty for beauty's sake, for practical.
Yeah.
Is an immensely American.
What good do contemplative nuns do?
What do they do?
Yeah, what
through the 19th century, there's order after order of contemplative nuns who the bishop said, come on over to America. You can set up a little daughter house here.
Right.
And they do. And then they're like, oh, by the
now
way, give up worshiping
run
God for a while and run the school. Yeah.
But I want to just point out one beautiful thing and this experience that I had, because I do think, especially as we're praying for this Eucharistic revival, which I hope you're all praying for sincerely, whatever you may think of whatever personalities are involved or
it's a huge, huge opportunity for grace.
Yeah.
Yes.
But we're in Cosmos and Damian this morning for the Basilica? Yeah, Basilica of Cosmos and Damian for Mass. And they have a 6th century, 7th century, 10th century?
The Mosaic?
The Mosaic.
I think it's 5th.
5th century, okay.
Maybe 6th, but very early.
The whole point of that mosaic, and I did not understand it until we were going up to communion, is Eucharistic. There's Christ in the middle. There's the apostles pointing at Christ. There's Cosmos and Damian being presented to Christ. There's later saints. So when you're walking up to communion, the effect that this apse has on you is this is who you're receiving. The whole thing points to the person of Jesus Christ. The point of the art is Eucharistic. And I don't know how you get back to that, the motivation of the art being the presentation of the sacramental life of the church. And even being there to draw you into the sacramental life of the church, until we revitalize the sacramental life of the church.
I think this is a point that needs to be stressed, and it's certainly something that people gathered with us have heard me say about a billion times over the course of the week. In that period from 3rd, 4th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th century, the church wanted you to think about this, as you describe it, when you went to liturgy. And that's why all of these apses and all these triumphal arches are all telling the same story.
Yeah. I think we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more, what is this? Flannel Panel on Catholic Answers Live from Rome right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
He is honored by the Church as a saint and the first diocesan priest to be declared a doctor of the Church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. John of Avila was known to his contemporaries as a spiritual master, and he served as a guide to some of the greatest saints of the 1500s. He also called for true reform in the Church and was a role model for the priesthood even today. He died in 1569.
To find out more, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. It's been a couple minutes of ads back home, but it's only been 1 second since we went away here in Rome. We're coming to you from Rome.
Time zones.
It's a different time zone that we're in. From the conference room of the Forum Hotel, which is called the Forum Hotel because it is right next to the Forum, a magnificent place to be. I do think there are advantages to coming to Rome with Chris Cech, and one of them is he will not accept a hotel that is not going to be right where you need to be. I have felt that the whole time. It's just wonderful to be here in this hotel right at the Forum. So I just want to say that, Chris, thanks for getting us here to the Forum Hotel.
What it means is if you pick a good location, you can see most of the city on foot, which is how it should be seen. I mean, we made use of a bus to, you know, get to St. Paul outside the walls, for example, or get over to the Holy See. Although that's walkable.
Did anybody track their steps any days here? Anybody want to give me a number
like 20,000
in a day? We did 20,000 steps in one day.
I got like 30 the other day.
You got 30 in the other day, so you were in Chris Cech's group. Okay.
Oh no, we left you at lunch and we didn't stop.
Oh, that's right. You guys went over to the Colosseum and all that.
For those listening who think, oh, being right in the middle of the city means you must not have walked as much. You didn't go with Chris Cech.
Yeah, right.
I think we were clear that this involved walking.
Yes. Well, you all knew there was going to be a walking tour. I want to move on to our topic number two. And as I said at the beginning, we usually talk about the news of the world from a Catholic perspective. Today, all the questions are questions that have been raised by members of this pilgrimage, pilgrims that have come with us. And this one has to do with babies. And I have to say, Romans are beautiful. I don't know. The Romans are just.
Your wife is
beautiful.
In the room.
No, but she says the same thing to me.
How do you know he was talking about the women?
Why? What are you suggesting about it?
He means all the people.
No, I mean the Romans. There is a Roman face. There is kind of a Roman face that they have, and you look at them and you go, "Well, that's a beautiful face." Yes. It doesn't matter if it's a man or a woman; they are beautiful, and then they're dressed to the nines. And then you come into their hotel and there's no iron, there's nowhere to hang your clothes, there's no drawers. I don't know where these people stay. Well, I guess they go to America when they stay in a hotel. So they're probably like, the Americans, they don't need anywhere to put their tennis shoes.
There is a towel warmer though.
There's a bidet, which I, to get into my shower, I have to do a back double gainer over the bidet. Like, have you noticed how the bathrooms are laid out?
Yes.
But the Romans themselves, they're unflappable. They have this expression on their face, like, do what you want. I'm getting there, whatever you do. And they step out into traffic. The cars stop for them. They are magnificent, beautiful people. And I was walking with Missy, my wife, today. And she turns around and she goes, oh my gosh, because there was this beautiful Roman couple with a perfect Roman baby in a carriage. And the father said, that's the right response. That's what he said to her. And she said, that's the right response, because this baby was beautiful. There's just not very many of them. And this is what people said, can we talk a little bit with the flannel panel about why there are so few babies in Europe? What is the meaning of that? Is there a remedy for that? Or just in general, whatever that brings to your minds about?
Well, it's a fact. Spain and Italy both have the lowest birth rates of the Mediterranean Catholic countries. I don't know if you call France Mediterranean or not, but I mean, they're slightly better. And there are actually some pronatalist efforts underway in France and in places like Russia.
It used to be called marriage, a pronatalist effort.
Well, I mean, encouraging people.
Or the honeymoon anyway, but.
This isn't that kind of show, sorry.
The Italians.
Well, it is Catholic. It's not a prudish show. It's a Catholic show. And we do know where babies come from.
If we want to know, here, we talk about church growth all the time. I can tell you where it's going to come from, in camera. That's where church growth is going to come from. Yes, this is the widespread use of the hormonal contraceptive beginning in the early part of the 20th century, and then really picking up steam in the second half. And I mean, there's reactions to it here and there, but not widespread reactions yet. And this country is contracepting itself out of existence.
There's a book called "The Religious Will Inherit the Earth," or "Will the Religious Inherit the Earth?" And it's written in a sort of anti-religious perspective, because it's a demographer who's worried because he realizes these secular people are not having children. And so you get this really fascinating phenomenon, like we're seeing it right now in Israel, where the people having kids are the extreme Orthodox.
The Hasidic. And,
yeah, exactly. Eric Kaufman, that's the demographer. And as a result of that, the politics are actually shifting. Because as you say, like most growth in most denominations, and Catholicism is no exception to this trend, most growth is from birth, not from conversions. This is basically universally true, and all but like you're, you know, if you start some weird upstart cult, you're probably going to get mostly converts before you get babies. But everybody who's established, most of the growth happens through families. And so, as secular people lose a sense that families are worth having, and as it becomes harder to accommodate a family because of that, because culture shifts around, right? Like it used to be, you'd have a really big family. And then it was like, well, six is a little too big. Now people are saying four is too big. And society changes. It becomes harder and harder to do that. Because then if you decide to be the one family that's going it alone, society's not built for you. And as a result of that, it's very difficult to do the courageous and right thing that society actually needs people to do in order to continue. This is not just a U.S. problem. This is not just a European problem.
It's a Western problem.
No.
Asian as well.
And Japan are in real demographic trouble.
And it won't be long, I think, until the more economically prosperous areas like urban Kenya, say, or South Africa are going to face these exact same pressures. Right. Secularization, declining birth rate, and everything that comes with it.
I would think the problem is especially exacerbated, and why we're noticing it in Rome is going to be in major metropolitan areas.
Yes.
And less so in the rural areas.
Well, I noticed even going down to Naples. So I lived here, you know, and so at one point I went down to Naples and I was with two of my friends, and we all three noticed like there are a ton of families down here, and there weren't. There were a normal number of families down there. But it was seeing that. Now, in Rome, it's also amplified because a ton of the people here are tourists. And if you go on pilgrimage or on vacation to Rome,
you're not bringing your kids with you.
And especially if you're going on Rome and you're walking around for miles, if you're a smart person, you're not. I mean, if you do bring your kids, you're probably, you know, taking a taxi or a bus everywhere you go. So some of it is a more exaggerated kind of impression because some of the people you're seeing aren't Romans. But despite that, the problem is real, and it is widespread.
And the solutions to it are multiple. It will begin with the example of the church. Any clergy who are listening who want their parishes to grow, you can encourage your people to throw out their pills. But the state has to work to provide incentives, whether they're credits or deductions or however they want to work it, encourage people to or not be afraid.
Let me jump in on
to
that.
Have children,
because I do think in the United States, conservative conservatives and pro-life people became the same people because the pro-life issue was so important to pro-life people that they made an alliance with American conservatives, and American conservatives couldn't win without pro-life people, so they made an alliance with pro-life people. But conservatism is a small government mentality in the United States, and what you're proposing is more Catholic than that. It's more Catholic than American. And the Catholic view is government has a responsibility to make family life possible. I mean, the basic teaching of the church, again, I'm quoting Father Hugh Barber, but I love him. You know, he said you could sum up in some ways the social teaching of the church by a man with a high school education should be able to support a wife and children. If you set up society that way, that's basically a just society. Around the edges, there may be problems, but that's basically, well, I mean,
yeah, this is not so in the United States right now. Yes.
No, but I'm asking you about the relationship between conservatism and big families. That conservatism tends to be a kind of laissez-faire, you're on your own thing, and that leaves families stranded in many cases.
Yeah, I think that's one variation of conservatism. I think you're seeing other, you know, so-called national conservatives. The Hungarian situation where they are taking more of an explicitly pronatalist approach.
Oh yeah, and that's a very right.
But I would say, as much as I support attempts to encourage this governmentally, the track record of these programs worldwide isn't good. I mean, Italy, in terms of big government, small government, Italy does much more, it seems to me, for citizens, and yet still has a worse
that's a very good point,
growth
Joe.
Rate.
Yeah,
so,
I hadn't thought about that.
So nothing will replace the creedal dimension. Like, people have to be personally convicted. I don't think anyone's saying, I don't want to start a family, but the tax credits are good.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett back in the studio in the United States. You're listening to the Flannel Panel recorded in Rome in November on Pilgrimage. Right back with more right after this.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. The Flannel Panel, Joe Heschmeyer, Chris Check, and we all went to Rome on pilgrimage with a bunch of pilgrims. And this is a recording that we're listening to of our Flannel Panel from Rome. We're right in the middle of a discussion about contraception, which was brought up by the fact that there are so few children in Italy.
The fundamental problem here is that the church has not fulfilled her mission to provide the moral teaching here. and for several decades. And everyone sitting in this room or listening to this program can count on one hand the number of times, unless they happen to be in one of these very unusual parishes, where they have heard the church's teaching on openness to life. Not so much the proscription on contraception, right, but the openness to life, the mutual self-giving, the not separating the unitive and the procreative, and how this has been the fundamental teaching of the church for all time. And it's just, it isn't heard. I mean, you're hard-pressed to find an average Sunday pew sitter who in fact is living this teaching, much less is capable of explaining it.
So I want to add to that. So we've taken a look, at least briefly, in terms of what governments could be doing and what priests could be doing. But I think there's a role also that we sometimes don't appreciate for what ordinary parishioners, ordinary Catholics, like most of the people listening to this, could be doing. And one of those things is, if you are a person who has a large family, celebrate that.
Yes.
Because so often, I think we want to be honest about the struggles with it, but we can sometimes exaggerate them or focus on them exclusively in a way that's really scary to people who are future parents, because they just hear all the horror stories. And so be honest about, you know, the joys and sufferings. One of the things I heard someone say before I got married was, it is so much better and harder than you imagine. And all of that's true. And so being able to be honest about all of that is, I think, really beautiful. So that witness does more than any of the things I think we've talked about. If you are in a friend group where your friends have large families, you're more likely statistically to have a large family. If you're in a friend group and where your friend gets divorced, you're more likely to get divorced. The peer influence plays this tremendously important role. And so, you know, John Paul II in Reconciliation and Penance talks about how all sin is social sin. And this is the flip side to the fact that the body of Christ exists, so everything we do, positively or negatively, has this ripple effect out. So even if your bishop's not sounding the alarm on this, even if your priest isn't, even if your government isn't, you can do things like encouraging families. If you have kids at home, celebrate that. If you've got grown-up kids, celebrate. You know, be honest about it. And then if you can do things to help make it possible to have a large family, that goes further than I think any government program cost possibly could. I'll give one example. I know I'm going long here. But my mom on Thursdays watches our small children for a few hours. It is huge because we can go and do things, or, you know, we can both be doing things at the same time. You know, we don't, there's a little less juggling than has to happen. There's a breather every week. I can't imagine an equivalent government program I'd feel comfortable just like dropping my kids off at, or anything like that.
You know, our Australian friend, Monica Dumit, I was very struck the very first time I met her. She's a single woman, and she's really given her heart and her life.
Australians, do you know her, Monica Dumit? You all know each other, right? Oh, yeah, they do. They know her. Okay.
Yeah. She's absolutely wonderful. I love her dearly. And very first time I met her, we were on a panel, and someone was asking about the single life. And she said, you know, if you're single and you want to be married, that's good. And I pray that you find your spouse and keep working for that. But in the meantime, is your sister married? Does she have children? Can you be the best auntie? Apparently that's an Australian word, auntie. Yeah. Can you be the best auntie that you can be and go and pick up her kids and give them a break or something like that? So extremely important point, Joe.
Apparently I speak Australian because I recognize the word auntie.
Auntie?
Yeah. Somehow it was familiar to me.
Auntie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it means your mom's sister.
I think it was Teresa was telling me about a Bible study where where moms could come to the Bible study, but they would have babysitting there. And yes. I think that parishes need to think this way more about, and maybe there's liability issues.
Take a giant boulder and smash it through your crying room and destroy it.
Well, I don't know because, I mean, you know,
crying rooms are postpartum contraception. Get rid of the crying room.
But there's parents.
Bring the crying babies to the front of the sanctuary.
But there's parents with disabled children and such. I would be careful about that because we want to have spaces where if you have a child who's very, very disabled, we want that child in church with us. Yes. So we got to have a place for them. And maybe the place is...
I didn't see a single crying room in Rome.
There,
in any one of these churches.
Well,
by the way,
Rome, babies weren't allowed to cry. That was not allowed. That's a modern invention.
Get rid of the crying room and also get rid of the pews. That's, well, that's a modern German invention.
You,
well, you do those two things, you're gonna have a lot more babies.
You, first of all, need to develop stronger opinions. And,
look, I like some German inventions, like strudel, right? Isn't that a?
but there are women in the parish, and I'm sure there's men too, but there's. For a young mom, there's a less creepy thing if it's older women or more mature women or women who have raised their children or whatever, or who can babysit while the moms get to get a couple hours. The moms will probably be like, we need a 12-hour Bible study and then, you know, or something like that. But there's more that we can do because I think, look, when they said to us, women should be in the workplace. They were there's nothing in the church that says women should not be in the workplace. But what we got was more expensive housing because people could pay more for housing because there were two incomes. That means that the one income family is struggling now in a way that it wasn't before. I'm not trying to litigate that. I'm just saying face the facts. The part of the reason that housing is so expensive is because there's a lot more money to buy bigger houses. There's not small, cheap houses for single earner families to live in. That means we need to help those parents more. We as a church need to recognize the social issues have changed and there is a justice element. If we're going to say to parents, have more kids, well, what are we doing in the parish to help those parents who actually have to work two jobs? You say, well, and in many cases, they may not have to, but there are families in which especially at the lower income levels, they're not going to be able to afford housing without two jobs. And so we got to step up to give them the time out like you
and
Anna
especially get. In light of Joe's example, because his is a multi-generational example. And the idea that you live near your parents or grandparents live near their grandchildren and all within in the same geographic region, that is not, I wouldn't call that common now. I don't even know that it is common. I think it's probably the...
Right, we're very mobile.
Yeah. And that's bad.
Statistically, people are more likely to live near the mom's family. And I think it's probably because of a lot of that for whatever reason, the mom's family seems to step up more. Or maybe mom feels more comfortable asking her own parents rather than her in-laws.
So if you want to see the grandkids, have daughters, is what you're saying, right?
If you want to see the grandkids, say, if you have kids, we'll watch them.
Yeah.
One day a week, or whatever it is. I mean, not everyone can give that much, but you can do something. And again, so those are all family examples. But the parish examples, I've given talks at parishes where they offer childcare, and I definitely see more young families when that's done.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It takes more work on the parish's end. And I don't do anything, so I mean, I'm saying this as someone who...
You can't just leave this up to priests. It's not a priest. It's the people of the parish have to go, Father, I will do this. Yeah.
Right, and so the priest can try to find people in the parish to help organize it.
Yeah.
But this is something that you can do at the lay level and basically have to do. The other thing I'd say here, just as a practical tip, is I've been in parishes where they offer service hour credit to those students who are earning service hours. And then you get students who are, you know, you don't have to be... licensed medical professional to watch toddlers while the parents are in the next room.
You know, there's a little student office on the campus of I think Ave Maria, and there's some other ones. I know Belmont Abbey, where students watch the babies of women who had unplanned pregnancies in the course of their undergraduate studies, and rather than kill their children. They deliver them and care for them, and then so that they continue to go to classes. So that's a similar kind of example.
Watch this, Chris. No reaction from Chris on this. Watch. We will probably get more children if we encourage young men to ask young women to marry them at a younger age. They don't need to be afraid. They can make it. They're terrified.
Yeah.
I was waiting for the yelling. Usually you yell about that, but
It is a puzzle to me. I know 5-10 times as many young women who want to be married as young men.
Isn't that sad?
It's perpetual adolescence. It's video games. It's
pornography, Chris. Don't leave it out.
Pornography. It's fantasy football.
The paradox of choice as well. That when you have too many choices, it's harder to make a decision. And so we live in an age in which there's a tremendous number of choices, not only between prospective spouses, but also, well, do I want to get married? Do I want to... all these other things.
Yeah.
So
I have fantasy football.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right.
I can't say a single nice thing about fantasy. It's ridiculous.
Actually ruins the game of football.
It does.
Root for a team. Don't root for one player on one team and one player on the other team. That's.
Can I tell you the other way to fix football, by the way?
I think that fixing football is one of the problems with it.
Sometimes I stop paying attention and then I lose. I just blacked out for a minute there, and then I was like, I came back. I was like, is this a different show we're doing now? Are we doing a sport show now?
This is a moral thing. And by the way, it's relevant to what we were talking about. Here's how you fix football. If you play on that team, you have to have been born in the city limits of that city. That stops the horse trading right away.
Again, you really need to develop stronger opinions about things. That'll do it for that segment. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live. It's the flannel panel from Rome right after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Hey, this is Michael O'Neill, the Miracle Hunter. I'll be delving into the fascinating world of miracles and taking you on a hunt that explores the greatest mysteries and marvels of the Catholic Church. I'll be examining what constitutes a miracle, how miracles are investigated and approved, and the role they play in the lives of the faithful. We'll look at the miracles of the Gospels and early Christianity, considering the claims of the miraculous in our own modern age.
The Miracle Hunter, tomorrow at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, coming to you live from the Forum Hotel in Rome, where we are on pilgrimage. It's the first of many hundreds, thousands maybe, flannel panel pilgrimages that we are going to do. We're very grateful to all those who came with us. During the break, a little bit of conversation about the men's side of this. And so I'll just run these two by you. And one, that there are women who are too hard on men. They're insisting on a certain level of income and various other accoutrements, I guess, before they'll consent to date. And the other is that men in the media are portrayed as not needed, as buffoons, as boobs was the actual word that was used. I will bleep that out when we run this on the air. But do you see what I'm saying?
I think this is true, but I don't think it's the principal problem. It is a lack of maturity among men. If I had to point to the larger demographic problem, it's that.
Yeah, also because even if you have, you know, you're attracted to one woman who has unreasonably high standards or just isn't interested in you for whatever reason.
Plenty of other choices.
Legitimate or
never
illegitimate.
Never had that problem, Joe, but all right, whatever.
I mean,
that was a joke. Come on. You're like, whoa, wow, that guy's got a problem. Go ahead, Joe.
In terms of the Catholic dating context, yeah. As Chris said, there are a lot more faithful young Catholic women who are marriage-minded from all appearances than there are faithful young Catholic men.
I think there are a lot more faithful Catholic women. I mean, that's always been the case.
I mean, yeah.
And it's too bad because it is a manly, virile religion. And the data shows, for example, that if the children are going to be Catholic or grow up Christian, their odds are vastly improved if dad's a practicing Catholic.
But this is actually, this is a very good point about Christianity. That our places of worship are not places for the men to go and worship while the women are home. Like, this is a female-dominated religion for a reason,
because
the center of it is a man who gives his life for us, not a man who wants to dominate, not a man who wants to crush or any of these other things. This is a religion that is attractive to women. Far more than almost every other religion on earth.
I want to build on that because in Ephesians 5, this is the model for men. And so to men and women out there who are still discerning a vocation, I'd say this. I'll speak to the men specifically, but there's corresponding stuff for the women. If you're looking for someone to just fulfill all of your needs and make you happy, you're not going to find them, and you're going to be perpetually unhappy, because that's ultimately a selfish kind of approach to another human being. But if you're looking for someone for whom you can suffer and who you can die for in slow motion, my wife always calls marriage martyrdom on an installment plan.
Especially when you're not around. She talks a lot about that.
Yeah, sandpaper ministry, she also calls it. You know, so
my wife calls me a hair shirt.
This was before we got married. This is how she sold marriage.
But has she stopped since? She hasn't changed her tune.
It's not funny anymore. Yeah. Well, but if that's the approach you go into, like, this is a person for whom I'm willing to suffer and be inconvenienced and lose a full night's sleep for, you know, if that's the approach you're going to have, then I think you're going to have a very good marriage. But if you go in expecting the other person to complete you and happily ever after, I think you're set up for disaster, and you probably won't end up married. And if you do, God help you both.
You know, the thing though about all that suffering in marriage is, and I do think one of the reasons that many marriages don't last is that people don't know that there's a second act and a third act to marriage. They think, well, once that first act is over and I don't love you anymore, or you're driving me crazy, they think that something has ended. And one of the things that Christians need to tell them about is that God loves you, and there's joy when you work through problems, when you get, you can go through, you know, I forget who it was whose father used to say about marriage. It might be Father Hugh Barber whose father used to say this. Sometimes you have a bad decade. And that's that, I think, is an important thing that they're, you know, like, so many of the couples here, you know, if everyone told their story, the story would be a story of suffering, but it wouldn't just be a story of suffering. It would be a story of rebirth, or else I would gather that you wouldn't be here together. And that rebirth is it's perfectly consistent with Christ's example to us, that dying in marriage also means rising again in marriage. And just because you think that this thing is so horrible and there's no hope, and I just can't deal with Missy anymore. I got a little personal. I apologize. On the other side of this, there's joy.
Yeah. Well said. I don't want to jump in because it feels a little personal, but yes.
Okay. All right. Well,
do the listeners know Missy's sitting in the room here? Or
is it? Her halo is actually shining while she endures this.
I know. Could you turn that down a little bit? Okay, I want to turn to you, Chris, for a minute, and then we'll get Joe to comment on this, because this is another thing that came up on this pilgrimage. There's a false narrative about the relationship between the Roman Empire and Christianity. Could you give us a little bit of a sense of what that false narrative is and why it's false?
Yeah, I think it goes something like this. For the first 300 years of Christianity, or from the crucifixion of Jesus Christ until the Edict of Milan, Christians were outcasts or rebels or illegals, hounded by a Roman government, and outlaws hounded by a Roman government. They had to hide in the catacombs. First of all, the catacombs are not places people hid. They're places people were buried. You couldn't hide in them. But you could for a little bit of time, but you certainly couldn't live in them. This isn't true. There certainly are periods of persecution of Christians, some quite violent and brutal, but also interspersed within these periods of persecution, there are periods of convergence between Christian and pagan Rome. I think it's a mistake to say, for example, that Christianity overcomes the darkness of pagan Rome. In fact, what it does is it transforms pagan Rome in Christ. And by the way, in so doing, it takes all those things in the Roman political order, and in the Roman imagination, in the Roman cultural life, in its buildings, in its political organization, and it baptizes them and makes them part of the church. I'll just cite one example or two of this: the Basilica, which is a Roman a political building for cultural, legal, and political life, that becomes the Basilica. That form that physical structure of what a basilica looks like, that becomes the early building for Christian worship. And in those apse mosaics that we're talking about at the very beginning of the program, what do we see? We see Jesus with the ad locutio motion with his right hand, the same motion of the Roman emperor. We see the senators, or rather the apostles, in the clothing of the senatorial of the patrician class. The Christians take these things and they make them their own. So yes, there are periods of persecution, but there are periods of convergence. And by the way, just there are periods where the Roman emperors, you know, say, well, you know, we're not going to do this. There are too many Christians already operating, and then in society, and then of course, like I say, come Diocletian, for example, it's brutal. But by that point, a lot of people die, but it's too late. The Christians are already, you know, too heavily involved. I recommend very much the work of an Italian scholar in this regard. Her name is Marta Sordi, S-O-R-D-I. Christians in the Roman Empire. It's the single best book to read on this topic.
I want to kind of complement that with the other side of it. I don't disagree, but I think some people hear this idea of baptizing pagan Rome and they have in mind a false narrative where we just like took all the statues to Jupiter and just slapped a halo on them and said, "Oh, this is, you know, this is St. Peter, this is whoever." And that's not historically what happened.
Well, we did take the obelisks and put, you know, Jesus and Mary on top
exactly.
of them.
Yes, exactly. So the obelisks, if you know, there's a famous obelisk, which is like a long, think about the Washington Monument. If you can visualize that, that's an obelisk. There's one of those in St. Peter's Square. The Romans had taken it from Egypt, and then the church took it and put a cross on top to acknowledge that, yeah, their gods that this was maybe originally built for don't exist, but here's a god who does. But what we didn't do was just convert paganism into Christianity in a nominal sort of way. I hope that makes sense. There's people who think Catholicism is just like a compromise with paganism. No. Imagine instead you go into a country that isn't Christian and you think, what would this country be like if one day it widespread converted to Christianity? And you wouldn't raise the country to the ground. You wouldn't destroy the culture. You would convert everything that can be redeemed, and you would put it in the service of Jesus Christ. And that's exactly what happened in Rome. And so one of the important kind of caveats I give here is that in the city of Rome itself, there was about a 200-year period where they wouldn't use any of the former pagan shrines as churches because they didn't want to confuse anyone. Like, no, paganism is dead and gone. This is a different thing, and this thing is true where the former thing was false. A lot of the former things, you know, aspects of that culture were beautiful and good. Something new has happened here, and we want to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I think a good way to say it is certainly as a matter of theology, we know that Jesus in the New Testament is fulfilling the old covenant. The new covenant, he is the fulfillment of the old covenant. But in a very similar way. Even if it's not so much formally theological, but certainly ecclesially, culturally, legally, in terms of the structure, there is a kind of a fulfillment of the Roman world by the Christian church. The Christian West is this unification, if you will, of revealed truth, in the scriptures, Greek thought and Roman political order, and they come together, and that's where Christendom comes from. And to say that Greek thought, which was pagan, or that Roman political order, which was pagan, that these things were just completely replaced, it's historically right. Not what happened. And by the way, in terms of intellectual history, it's not what happened.
Hey, this is Cy Kellett back in the United States in the studio. I really hope you enjoyed this version of the flannel panel that came from Rome. We were in Rome in November for our pilgrimage. It's not yet become a regular pilgrimage, but we've done two of them, and maybe we'll do another one in a couple years. That could be a big one. I don't know if we'll go in 2025, but I hope we will, because that's Jubilee year. Every 25 years, we have a Jubilee year. The holy doors will be open in the four main basilicas of the Catholic Church, and that would give us an opportunity to pass through each of the holy doors. If you're interested in coming, on a Catholic Answers pilgrimage in 2025 to Rome, or if you're interested in anything else or you want to talk to us about anything else, you can always get in touch with us, radio@catholic.com. Just shoot us an email, radio@catholic.com, and we'll keep you updated as things happen. Today is the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. Mary conceived immaculately. We are off for that celebration. Coming up next, the game show with Carla Broussard on Catholic Answers Live.